Thank you. It's a blessing to sponsor the event. It's also a blessing to be here to speak, and also a blessing to answer any call that we must answer to, you know, especially with Molly when she wants us to, you know, sponsor any of the events. We just want to get our message out, but also I'm grateful to be part of the pro-life movement here in Ohio. Even though I come from Arizona, I'm not really used to this snow either. So, yeah, what I'm going to share with you today is a vision we have. A vision on how we can reclaim authentic Christian healthcare in our country. And I'm going to start out talking about God versus Caesar and what that looks like and what God, what government has done to healthcare and what insurance companies have done to healthcare. And then I'm going to talk about the role of the church, what the role of the church needs to be in healthcare reform and even in society. And then we're going to talk a little bit about your role in society and how to form healthcare. And then we'll take some questions towards the end. We may get into some material cooperation and evil, too. So that's always a fun topic when you talk moral theology. But a lot of my talk, the basis of this talk is in this little booklet here, The Catholic Solution to the Healthcare Problem. And so you can pick that up at our booth out there. And if you want any more information on Solidarity, please let you know. And just to get this out of the way first is Solidarity HealthShare is a national not-for-profit ministry. That attempts to be faithful to the teaching of the Catholic Church when it comes to how we pay for our health care, to how we keep it in a moral perspective. And what we do as a leadership team at Solidarity HealthShare, we just, number one, get the best cash pricing for our members pursuant to those guidelines and the moral teaching of the church. And then number two is we help facilitate the payment of those medical expenses, the sharing of those medical expenses among our membership. Fair enough? Okay. So hopefully the legal stuff is as exciting as I get excited about, so I apologize for that. But as a lawyer, religious liberty lawyer, I have a lot of fun talking about this. So the Pharisees went off and plotted how they might entrap Jesus in a speech. They sent their disciples to him with the Herodians saying, "Teacher, we know that you are a truthful man and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. And you're not concerned with anyone's opinion, for you do not regard a person's status. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it lawful to pay the census tax to Caesar or not?" Knowing their malice, Jesus said to them, "Why are you testing me, you hypocrites? Show me the coin that pays the census tax." Then they handed him a Roman coin, and he said, "Whose image is on this inscription?" They replied, "Caesar's." And then they said to him, "Then repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and God what belongs to God." You know, we know that scripture passage from Matthew. But if we look at the significance of that, you know, in Jesus Christ times, the image of Caesar was everywhere. You know, it was on all over the Roman Empire on busts, statues that showed Caesar to show exert his power and control over the people. Fair enough? That's the whole what he did. Another thing too is showing that the people belong to Caesar. That's the reason we do this. And the same thing when you walk into an embassy, or I get to D.C. a lot, and what do you see when you go to an embassy or you go to D.C. in these health and human services? You got a picture of Trump everywhere, right? And it's the same concept as we're showing that the people of the United States belong to our government. However, we're different as Catholics and Christians because we're in this world, but we can't be of this world. And so we're marked and made by the image of God, and we're molded in his image. Our inalienable rights come from our Creator, and no government individual can infringe upon those. So that's the basic underlying premise of the conflict. And I apologize for this long quote coming up, but it really sets up this whole conflict that we have between government and the church and conscience issues. And it's the person who, it's actually an Italian cardinal who's attributed to this on one of his reflections. "The various emperors of the world can strip the church of every resource, discredit it in every way, make it powerless to do the works of the gospel, but no one will ever be able to take the gospel away, the joy of its Lord. No earthly authority will be able to possess the heart of man forever through the propaganda of lies, with mass promises and apparent democracies. The conscience can remain dazed for a long time, but sooner or later something happens that reawakens and regenerates it. since at the root there is an indestructible core, the desire for the truth, and the need for good. So let no one be deceived. Christianity can be reduced to a visible minority, but it can never be eliminated. Because the Lord said, "Do not be afraid, for I am with you until the end of the world." And because the human soul is made for God, and this is stronger than all of the persecutions and all of the lies that circulate so rapidly in the air today. Today, in the name of values like equality, tolerance, rights, the aspiration is to marginalize Christianity, to create a world order without God, where differences are glorified on one side and crushed on the other. This is true for the peoples of the nations. However, if we look at the results, we have to conclude that it began with good intentions, but with erroneous decisions. The overbearing will to homologate, to want to the condition the profound visions of life and behaviors, the systemic annulment of cultural identities, all of this resembles a journey toward a deleterious refoundation that the population recognizes as oppressive and arrogant, where Christianity is considered divisive because it does not bow down before the emperor du jour. And then history attests that when those in power concentrate on their own survival out of personal ambition, turning away from the common good, it's in the time of decline. Marginalizing Christianity from the public sphere is a sign, not of intelligence, but of fear. It is failing to see through the dark clouds of prejudice that society cannot help but benefit from Christianity. The more one seriously studies the origins of humanism, and the more he recognizes the existence of something that is not only spiritual but distinctly Christian, that's the issue there. You kind of see this, how this plays out in our reality here in the United States with how the government and the church is clashing right now in healthcare. So going back right when the Affordable Care Act was passed, an alleged faithful Catholic, Sibelius, she was head of the Health and Human Services that actually implemented all these contraception mandate, and everything that we see with the minimum essential coverage. And Archbishop Nauman, a great man from Kansas City, the bishop there, publicly admonished her. He tried to do it in private first, but it didn't work. The other things you see, too, is when our leadership, like Nancy Pelosi, says she's not sure the church has an understanding of when life starts. Could you imagine making a statement like that? And so I think the church has a pretty good idea when life starts. And then what really got me, too, is when President Obama lifted the embryonic stem cell research ban. And so then that allowed embryonic stem cell research to flourish again. That was one of his first executive orders that he did. And we see this, too, with in nurses, how they're forced to violate their conscience. So not only am I talking about a lot of these issues from the individual when we procure and ask for health care and pay for health care, also look at the provider through all this, too. So the provider consciences are supposed to be protected by God and protected through our government, but they're not. And there was a nurse at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. She was forced to participate in a gruesome, violent dismemberment abortion. And she was told that if she did not participate in the abortion of a 22-week-old baby, she would be charged with insubordination and terminated. And the Alaska Supreme Court recently ruled last year that a private, non-sectarian pro-life hospital must start performing abortions. In Oregon, a woman is denied doctor-prescribed cancer treatment by the insurance company, but offered drugs for physician-assisted suicide. I call it the Not-So-Affordable Care Act because it's what it's doing to the middle class right now. But look at the mandates that have happened out of the Affordable Care Act. Employer mandate, the individual mandate, the abortion premium mandate, and what I call the Friday the 13th mandate because it was passed on Friday the 13th of May two years ago, where we're forced to, through our insurance, to fund gender reassignment surgeries and such. And then the latest, too, you saw in the news with Bishop Papaki publicly scolding Senator Durbin. Now, just to let you know canonically how that works is the bishop always does it privately first in a letter, calls the individual in, the public official, to try to correct that behavior to avoid scandal. But then once the politician goes public, then that forces the bishop to go public. So that's usually the case. I just don't want you to think that a bishop's out there attacking politicians. But I think we may need more of that today to make them more accountable. And I apologize where we are on the slides here. Okay. The next thing I just want to share with, what's the role of the church? And as Christians, do we have a right to be in the public sphere? If you heard the argument, it was founded by Senator Clinton, or what do you call her now? Just Hillary Clinton? I can't remember what her title is. But yeah, when she was the Secretary of the Estate, what did she do? She started proclaiming a new right under the Constitution, the right to worship. You know, and so you have the right to worship in your house or in your church, but don't you dare bring that infectious disease called Christianity to the public sphere. So you can see, she said that over 14 times publicly in a few months. And luckily it didn't stick. So, but if you look at it, that's the mindset of a lot of people, especially some liberals in this country, to try to extinguish our vote. But what are we here? And I'll give you some examples of the history of the country. There was a Toleration Act in 1689 in Maryland when Catholics were outlawed from even holding public office. Did anybody know that? And so there was one Catholic that signed the Declaration of Independence, Charles Carroll. And if you go to the National Archives, you can see him. He's the first one on the left with his back to you. I don't know what the significance of that painting is at the National Archives. And then if you ever get a chance to, there's a great document that talks about this tension. And how I explain it the best is this. I was at a meeting at the Vatican at Cor Unum, which means one heart. It's the Pope's philanthropy arm for the church. And Monsignor Del Tozzo, who is now an archbishop, did a great job at explaining the difference between social justice and charity to me. Because right now it's integrated into one dicastery in Rome. But he said social justice is like Thomas More. So what did Thomas More do? He was a very faithful Christian, very faithful Catholic. He tried to influence King Henry VIII. You know, this is wrong what you're doing. You know, marriage is for life, this, and this. And so he was inserting his moral beliefs, tried it in the public sphere, and you know what the ending happened there, right? Lost his head. Well, the other side of it is charity. And the church has both of these functions to perform. And the one function of charity is, he gave a great example of Mother Teresa. You know, she very rarely preached the gospel. But what she did is she went into the slums in India and even everywhere around the world and just grabbed people up and loved them during their last moments of death and take care of them and was a true witness to Christ. The church and us here, we have both of those functions. Not only we serve the poor through Caritas, through charity, but we need the church. We need the church to ground ourselves in some type of higher spirituality. The difference between right and wrong, then we can take that teaching to the public sphere. Agreed? That's the goal of what this is. And Pope Benedict talked about this, and what I love most about Pope Benedict is when he came in, everybody thought he was such a hardliner, right? We got a German shepherd coming in, or a German bulldog coming in, you know, to just be doctrine. But his first encyclical, and a papal encyclical, the first encyclical usually defines where their pontificate is going. So does everybody know what his first encyclical was? Deus Caritas Est, God is love. So what does a German, you know, cardinal know about love? You know, I just thought it was great. But in there, in paragraph 28, he talks about this. It is not the church's responsibility to make this teaching prevail in public life. Rather, the church wishes to help form the consciences in political life and to stimulate greater insight into the authentic requirements of justice, as well as the greater readiness to act accordingly, even when this might involve conflict with situations of personal interest. So another thing you look at is Archbishop Chaput talked about this in his book, Render Unto Caesar, divorcing religious faith from the public life. Now, remember the Founding Fathers? They assumed that the populace in the United States were going to be well-formed consciences through their God and through their religion, right? That's why there's, you know, you hear the separation of church and state, which doesn't exist in the Constitution, by the way. But if you hear these things, a well-formed populace was needed to keep the government in check. So when we divorce this, like Chaput talks about here, that's when we get into trouble today. The second reason we're in trouble today with our health care is we've abrogated our moral right over to an insurance company to decide to pay for everything. And we have to take both of those issues back. So Archbishop Chaput talked about divorcing religious faith from public life. It soon leads to separating government from morality. Do you think we're there yet? And citizens from their consciences. That leads to politics without character. So if you take these quotes, that's kind of where we are today. And I think Michael Voris talked about humana vitae. And I'm not going to go through those rites here. I don't know how much time I have because this clock says I'm at 43 minutes. Okay. Okay. I'll just go until Molly tells me to. Okay. All right. I'm going to leave time for questions. One of the most profound things when I read Humana Vitae, you know, this is the 50th anniversary here, July 28th, is when Paul VI warned about, you know, contraception and such, and he said, the abuse of power in those in public authority by imposing artificial contraception upon its people. Paragraph 23. And I read that, I don't know, maybe like 10 years ago. I said, everything else came true. What the heck is Pope Paul VI thinking about? And he was just, Pope Francis is just going to elevate him to sainthood, too. It'll probably be this fall in October. It was just released this week. But if you look at it, I thought he was crazy when I read that. But now look what happened with the Affordable Care Act. It's forcing contraception upon everybody to pay for it. And so, and if you look at this whole Affordable Care Act, Lehman and the Affordable Care Act was a farce because it was designed to raise the taxes on the middle class. So everybody in this room, if you're employed, pays 0.9% more in payroll tax to fund the Affordable Care Act. And you got all these other taxes in there, the device tax and everything. And it was a tax bill. That's why they passed it under reconciliation through the Senate. And I still don't, no one can answer this question for me. Where are tax bills supposed to originate from? From the House, right? This bill originated in the Senate, and it ends up being an appropriation bill. An appropriation bill cannot rise out of the Senate. So this whole bill is unconstitutional based on its face. But no one's, I guess where we are right now and what I learned in law school, I went to a pretty bad Jesuit law school. And I remember talking about that, and I was challenging these professors about, you know, what about natural law? Oh, no, natural law doesn't mean anything. What? How do we form our laws against the truth of Jesus Christ and His church and God? You know, that's how I was brought up. Now, it's about positive law, Mr. Hahn. You know, it's whatever, as long as you follow the process correctly, that makes law. Well, we didn't even follow the process correctly. This isn't natural law based. This isn't positive law based. But now we're stuck with this law. All right. I'm going to go in a little bit, too, about what the proper role of government should be. Then we'll get to health care reform, because that's probably everybody wants to talk about health care reform, right? Does everybody get excited about health care reform, or is it just me? Okay. All right. So, and it's a very simple solution to health care reform. And I'm not going to tell it to you now. We'll wait a couple more minutes, so just to keep you waiting here. But Thomas Jefferson was quoted in his writings that's been published. No provision in our Constitution ought to be dearer to man than that which protects the rights of conscience against the enterprises of civil authority. And so right there, we're talking about a conscience protection, clearly. And in the Federalist Papers, Jay Madison said, conscience is our most sacred of all property. So when you hear life, liberty, and property, they're talking about conscience there. And they've actually tangibilized this. But if you look at it, where we've come, and everybody is familiar with Roe v. Wade. And but there's a companion release there was Doe versus Bolton, which actually says the right created under Roe v. Wade does not require participation by any person or entity who may object to abortion. And the protection of conscience is entirely appropriate. Did you know that's in the companion ruling from Roe v. Wade? Does anybody ever talk about that? No, it's all about the absolute right to abortion. Okay, so this role of government here, I'm not going to go through all these amendments, the church amendments, the Coates Snow amendments, and all these amendments. These amendments by the federal government are responses to judicial decisions where judges have overruled and violated people's consciences. And so one thing you hear about, too, is I'll just talk briefly about that, is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You probably hear that a lot, or I do anyway. So I don't know what you people are reading, but I see it all the time. Basically, this is kind of a standardized test when government can force to violate your conscience. And there's a reason why I'm telling you this story in a second. Government shall not substantially burden a person's free exercise of a religion unless furthering a compelling interest, and it has to be by the least restrictive means. Great constitutional law. Maybe I'm the only one getting excited about this. But if you look at it, why do I bring this up? I remember Bill Cosby always says, you know, yeah, I'm sick, but then he always has to say, I'm sick and tired, right? Because that's what your parents always say. To me, it's a tiresome argument right now. Conscious protection in healthcare. Under the Bush administration, we had some conscious protection issues, you know, and we're protected to a certain extent, even though under the Bush administration, Health and Human Services really set up the argument for taxpayer funding of euthanasia, if you go read through some of the Health and Human Services writings that were released under the Bush administration. So we think we're happy here. We got conscious protection. Obama comes in, strips all the conscious protections away, right? And then now everybody's praising Trump for instilling all these rules now to protect conscience. To me, brothers and sisters, that's not the answer. We're basically involved in a ping pong match, right? Who's ever in the administration has determined what our conscience protection is going to be. We need a permanent solution. We need the federal government to pass some long-lasting laws that protects our conscience from an administration. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
So, and God bless Trump for what he's doing, but I think when Republicans get in power, they make stupid decisions. And here's one stupid decision they've made. You remember when under Bush the Second, when they were so proud pushing through abstinence teaching, hundreds of millions of dollars of abstinence teaching in public schools? And I'm thinking, that's the most asinine thing I've ever heard. Because what's going to happen when that money gets in the hands of the next president? And now what happened? Planned Parenthood takes that money, and now they're educating everybody in our schools. Now look at what Trump's done here with the Office of Civil Rights under Health and Human Services. Did you know there's a police force inside Health and Human Services? I'm gonna ask you a question here. I still don't know what Health and Human Services does. I've had several meetings with them. How many employees do you think they have? I'll just take a guess. 33,000? I asked this question to the person who runs the Civil Rights Office there, and he says, do you mean nationally or internationally? And I was like, excuse me, what the heck are Health and Human Services doing over in China? You know, what are they doing over there? They have over 120,000 employees. Do you think we could cut back some of these employees back there? Yeah. But what really concerns me greatly in this Office of Civil Rights is now they have a power to fine people for conscience violations. So we're sitting here, I'm forced to violate my conscience, participate in abortion, or I'm an anesthesiologist and I'm forced to give anesthesia to somebody who's going to get sterilized, tubal ligations and such, and I'm forced beyond my will, that provider, that hospital company can be fined by Health and Human Services right now. Under the Obama administration, only 6 cases went through to try to do that. But now look at the power we've given to this little unregulated, unsupervised body within Health and Human Services. What's going to happen if we get another president like Obama in there? What's he going to do to the Christian conscience with this, he's basically weaponized this little Office of Civil Rights. Am I overreacting here? You know, and I still love Ronald Reagan when he was inaugurated in 80 at his speech, and he said, you know, government is not the solution to the problem. Government is the problem. Right? And I'll tell you what, right now with to make government irrelevant in your life when it comes to paying for health care, and this is my wife just says, Brad, thank you so much for starting Solidarity HealthShare. Not only one, are we saving money and I can plan a good budget for this next year, but number two, I know I'm not paying for things I find morally objectionable. And so Julie's like saying, this is a blessing that you brought to this family. You know, and that's what we're trying to do at Solidarity HealthShares. Make the federal government irrelevant in your life and let me deal with the federal government, because it's ridiculous what we're having. So now we're getting a big push from dioceses, from major religious organizations, for-profit businesses, high schools, colleges. Brad, you got a great protection here for the individuals. I can participate in Solidarity HealthShare. I'm not forced to pay for things I find morally objectionable, like contraception, abortion, gender reassignment, euthanasia, and such. But what are you doing for me? I'm a business owner. I have 150 employees. I'm working with one Catholic nonprofit right now, has 20 employees. Their medical costs are $600,000 a year for a Catholic not-for-profit. And so how can we fix and have Solidarity HealthShare be a solution for these businesses? Because it's not right that I'm violating my conscience. So I go to D.C. a lot. And I was meeting with, I'm not going to tell you who the senator was I was meeting with. Maybe I should. No. But what happened was I told him that story. And I said, what are you doing to protect these business owners' conscience? I said, don't we have a fundamental right to protect our conscience? Then the government should not coerce us to violate that. You know what he said? Good luck with that argument around here. These are our elected officials. So do we have a problem here? Yeah, and so that's the whole picture here is with this. I would like to say that we can solve this through lawyers, you know, because you know, I'm a lawyer. You know, I think lawyers can solve a lot of the world's problems, but I'm joking about that, by the way. So, but if you look at it, how can we weaponize the pro-life movement against healthcare is basically through litigation. And that's what we're seeing. And to me, you know, litigation is cumbersome. It's expensive. Lawyers win. They're the only ones that usually win and make the money. How come we can't set up a vision for healthcare where it's an alternative to insurance? Where all these games that are being played in the insurance company, because listen to this. The entity that controls the payer system for healthcare controls the morals and ethics. Would you agree with that? Yeah. As Christians, we've abrogated all of our moral authority in healthcare, and we've given it to the federal government, the state governments, and big insurance companies. Oh, and by the way, can I tell you what the health insurance profits were up 2 years ago? They are up 46%. That's because of the Affordable Care Act. It's not so affordable to us, but it's really affordable to the big insurance companies because they're the ones that have taken all the money. And so the more I think about this, we have to reclaim an authentic Christian healthcare system again in this country where we as lay people, we control the payer system and we control the morals and the ethics. That's the only way we're going to be able to reclaim our Christian values in healthcare. Our government's not going to give it back to us because once the government takes it, they never give it back. And sure enough, these insurance companies aren't protecting us. Well, maybe they are. Maybe I'm mistaken here. But. And so look at the Affordable Care Act mandates. Sorry, I get talking. I forget I've got a clicker in front of me. So does that mean I'm done? Okay. All right. Look at the mandates that we have in the Affordable Care Act. The individual mandate compels everyone to have health insurance or pay a fine. And by the way, there is exceptions to that for the individual mandate. You can even be in prison. And right underneath the prison exemption is the Christian health sharing ministry. So I don't know what that means under the code that we're so close to the prison exemption, but hopefully it's not fortuitous there. But if you look at it, I just want to say this now, and it really concerns me that President Trump said this at the State of the Union. He's been saying it repeatedly that we basically rendered the Affordable Care Act useless because what we've done is we've abolished the individual mandate. Have they abolished the individual mandate? They reduced the fine to zero. The individual mandate is still the law of the land. And so now it's going to take the next Congress to come in and pass it through reconciliation, which you just mean 51 votes in the Senate, and the mandate's back on. Okay, but that's another separate issue. The other separate issue with the individual mandate is the Affordable Care Act coverage mandates are still in place. So the Affordable Care Act coverage mandates includes minimum essential coverage, abortion, contraception, sterilization. Oh, you also have to have free HIV testing and counseling and also for venereal disease, for sexually transmitted disease. That's all free counseling and such like that. So four out of the eight requirements in the Affordable Care Act coverage mandates has to deal with, you know, impromiscuous sex. You know, that to me, that's what it's about. And here's something else that really, if I'm not fired up enough, well, maybe you'll get a little fired up about this. But you know what the Affordable Care Act for employers over 50 with the employer mandate? The only thing that's required under the law is minimum essential coverage, which is preventative services. It did nothing for the people to increase the value of their health care. So an employer over 50 can just offer, make sure contraception's paid for, abortion-inducing drugs paid for, sterilizations are paid for, HIV counseling, you know, and also they put breastfeeding in there and some other issues like that. That's the only thing you have to cover now. And what's that for? A lot of large employers now, that's the only thing they are covering because it gets so expensive. So this whole Not-So-Affordable Care Act was a sham. It basically lined the pockets of the insurance companies. All right. We do have some hope here with these mandates, and I kind of picked on Trump a little bit with the Office of Civil Rights, but he did have in his latest rule actually state in there that members of health sharing ministry is a class that should be protected under federal law, and actually cited the Affordable Care Act statute. Oh, I forgot. The reason I did talk about the balancing test that we do under constitutional law is because if you go read through the contraception mandates and everything under the Obama administration, you read the arguments, it's the same arguments. They're quoting the same cases, same case law, same history, different conclusion. Everybody must pay for contraception. You look at this rule here, it's the exact same writing. I know the gentleman who wrote this, he added some good language in there, but it's just a different conclusion. It was the least restrictive means compelling interest test, but they used the same facts. They just had a different conclusion. So the point there is, next president comes in, it could flip back to contraception because it's a different conclusion. All right? Okay. I'm just going to talk briefly about this. I don't have time to get into a lot of detail on this. Apologize for going on some of these tangents here. But something we always have to analyze when we have any type of behavior is whether we're cooperating in evil or not. And I just want to touch basically on this. And so it's called the moral principle of cooperation in evil. And so it's basically how assists us in discerning whether to avoid, limit, or distance ourselves from certain evil acts. That's the whole goal here. So the form of cooperation of evil is pretty clear, and I'll just give you some examples of this. An explicit form of cooperation of evil would be the cooperator directly approves the principal agents of the immoral act, which means like a Catholic hospital, the CEO drafts and implements a policy permitting the direct sterilization of patients in the hospital. That's a clear direct form of cooperation of evil because the CEO orders that. You agree? And that's, I know, a Catholic hospital that recently happened to. So the other one could be kind of an implicit form of cooperation where the cooperator intends evil but is used for some other end. And so I'll give an example. The hospital CEO negotiates and approves a collaboration agreement with another hospital to perform the sterilizations or the abortion. So that CEO is still cooperating in evil, the formal. The lesser known is kind of the material cooperation, and this happens every day. So even driving on the streets, we cooperate with evil because our taxpayer dollars are funding the roads, and a guy who just robbed a bank is using the roads. So that's kind of but you can see where that's so remote in the cooperation. It's kind of a ridiculous example, but I use that for effect. And so the immediate material cooperation evil, where the cooperator does not share in the intentions of the agent who is actually doing the evil, but participates anyway and actively participates in the commission of that act. So an example of that would be an anesthesiologist contributes to bringing about a direct sterilization because the anesthesiologist actually applies anesthesia to render the person whatever state that is called, and then allows this direct sterilization to happen. But a janitor would be kind of more remote because the janitor is just, you know, preparing the facility afterwards. But again, that type of cooperation evil is always morally illicit, and it's not never allowed. Where we get into these issues here with the immediate cooperation of evil occurs when, and this is what it relates to you. So, you know, I'm trying to use a little Catholic guilt on here to shame you in for all those that still have traditional health insurance. Is that okay to do? Or so? No, but the immediate material cooperation evil occurs when the cooperator participates in circumstances that are not essential to the commission of the act. And the action could have occurred without any cooperation on behalf of the person who cooperates. So the janitor in the above example would be, you know, the act was going to happen anyway, whether the floor was cleaned or not. And so when you look at the immediate cooperation, it can be justified if there's a proportionality where there's a proper proportion between the good that is being sought and the evils that are present. So an example of that would be, let's apply this to health insurance. So participating in the Affordable Care Act is I'm funding abortions, I'm funding contraception, I'm funding gender reassignment surgeries and the like. But what's the proportionality of me participating in insurance to bring about a greater good because my family needs their medical expenses paid, right? But even though today that argument is really lessened because how people are paying more for their health insurance now than they are their mortgage, right? And so that argument's lessened. But the other one is kind of the other issue that can justify it, and all three of these conditions need to be met, proximate versus remote. And so we look at the proximity between the action and the principal's action. And so this is so remote because I'm paying into this fund, but then someone else is doing the abortion. I have no counsel on that abortion. I'm not trying to dissuade that person at all. It's so remote, so it could be justified. But here's where the kicker is, for me anyway. There has to be no other alternative available. So now with medical cost sharing with Solidarity, we do have an alternative way to fund medical costs. Is that shameful? I'm just looking at the church teaching and just trying to make an argument here. So I'm no moral theologian. I'm only certified in bioethics. So I'm kind of armed and dangerous with a little bit of knowledge here. So if there's any moral theologians out there, they can always correct me. Or I'm sure you're going to correct me after this anyway, Luke, so go ahead. And so to me, that's problematic. And even with all of that being said, there is a portion. How complicated this law is, there's also a thing called the abortion premium mandate where every single exchange in a state has to have a pool for funding for abortions where at least $1 goes to this fund. You know how long it took me just to analyze that one paragraph? It took me 6 hours one day, reading through the statutes because it's so complicated. You have Hyde issues. You have then it goes to the fund the states. Now, can the state fund abortion? Does that violate the federal law? And it's ridiculous how complicated. It's only as complicated as trying to offer Solidarity Health Share to businesses because we're dealing with ERISA, church plans, not church plans, the Affordable Care Act, under 50 employees, over 50 employees, Department of Labor rulings. But you know who the most confusing is? The IRS, the Department of Revenue. So if you look at the Department of Revenue there, and you'll love this because when you say what a qualified benefit plan is, both between ERISA, Department of Labor, and the IRS, they all have three different definitions for these terms. And so it's incredibly complicated. One thing I'm going to share with you too is, you know, Luke, you're sitting looking at me, is you can't cooperate in health insurance either because that option. But to me, I got another moral issue with healthcare. The Affordable Care Act is rigged. It's rigged in favor of insurance companies. And I'll give an example. In 2016, health insurance companies earned $13.1 billion. That's an increase of 46% from 2015. And you remember how President Trump tried to stop the cost-sharing payments to reimburse the insurance companies? You know what the insurance companies did? They raised their silver level plan to a certain level and triggered other federal subsidies on top of that. So tell me that's not rigged against them. I was speaking with a White House official a couple weeks ago, and I said, Trump can't win. And he can't repeal this. And we got one member from Pennsylvania who just signed up for Solidarity Health Share. He was on an Affordable Care Act plan. He had a $14,000 deductible for his family. And his premiums were jumping from $1,600 to $2,400 a month. I don't know any middle-class family that can fund $42,800 per year before their health insurance kicks in. Do you? So we got a problem here. Would you agree? Yeah, and so how am I doing on time, Molly? Okay, questions? A couple minutes then? Okay. All right, read this book, this pamphlet I wrote, because it's going to cover the stuff I didn't get a chance to talk about tonight. But I just want to say the reason we called it solidarity is after the Catholic social teaching is we need to come together and form a community of like-minded believers that believe in Jesus Christ and his church, understand the moral and ethical issues in healthcare, and just refuse to cooperate in that system. And you're going to be freely be able to make sure your conscience is not violated. But number three is we can really have a great payer system. And I'll give you an example. So that's why we named it solidarity. Because, brother helping brother, community helping community. We come outside ourselves to share. The other reason we started this business, I can call it business, a not-for-profit, is to comply with the principle of subsidiarity. You know, subsidiarity says that societal problems are best solved by those that are most effective at the lowest possible level. Okay? So to me, you're in a doctor's office, you got a sore throat. He sees a white pustule on it. So what does he do? He goes and looks at the handbook that's out by Health and Human Services. Only these three issues I can prescribe to you now from this, because that was what Health and Human Services issued. Or he goes, and my favorite thing is when you go to the doctor, what insurance company do you have? Why does that make a difference? Right? Yeah, and so if you look at it, who's making our medical decisions right now for us? The insurance companies and government. That clearly violates the principle of subsidiary. Solidarity Healthshare, what we do is we got to restore that again, where the doctor and the patient are making these decisions, and then have a mechanism to fund those great decisions, where these doctors can only spend like a minute per patient right now. That's got to change. And so that's what I'm inviting you to do, is to come on board and try to reclaim an authentic Christian system where we comply with the teaching of the church on the ethical issues, the moral issues, and with all the social teaching. And I just want to leave you with one thing, too, is we need everybody involved. And so I love the solemn charge in 2 Timothy 4, 1 through 5. I charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who will judge the living and the dead, and by his appearing and his kingly power, proclaim the word, be persistent whether it is convenient or inconvenient, convince, reprimand, that was for you, the reprimand part, so encourage through all patience and teaching, for the time will come when people will not tolerate sound doctrine, but will follow their own desires and insatiable curiosity, will accumulate teachers and will stop listening to the truth and will be diverted to myths. But you, be self-possessed in all circumstances, put up work with hardship, perform the work of an evangelist, and fulfill your ministry. So what is our most important ministry? To get to heaven, right? So let's do the right thing. Let's take back our health care. And let's help our brothers and sisters along the way. So. And read this book. So. You're welcome.
That's wonderful. So. Thank you very much. Okay.
Yeah.
So we've got a couple of minutes for questions, and I think that some of them are very good here. So, with the expense of drugs rising, with some specialty drugs costing as much as $5,000 to $60,000, how do you cover these? It seems that discounts are not enough.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we don't cover anything because we're not insurance. That's an insurance term. But what we do for prescription drugs is if it's related to an incident, you know, like a catastrophe, a disease or something like that, it's a shareable medical expense. But recurring medical expenses we don't share in, like high blood pressure medicine and such like that. But we have a great discount program that we're working on where our members can get the best cash pay price, better than insurance, 90% of the time. And then that 10% that we can't get, we're working right now through some other collaborators to try to get that donated. You know, that's what's nice about what we do, because we're not for profit. We're a bunch of Christians trying to take back healthcare. And I can't believe how blessed we are working with some of these pharmaceutical people. You know, and even the doctors, once they found out we're a Christian organization and what we're about, they start discounting stuff for us. So that's the one way we answer that. So,
yeah. This is an interesting one. Okay. If a daughter of a member becomes pregnant outside of marriage, would you pay for the cost of the birth?
Well, just to let you know, there's a little federal law out there called the Pregnancy Protection Act, and where health insurance cannot discriminate against that. And I just rewrote our member guidelines to make that a shareable medical expense, because I know that's one of the issues with a lot of these Christian health sharing ministries. They don't share in those expenses. But my big concern is I want that to be a shareable medical expense, because I don't want to push any unwed pregnancy to an abortion clinic. And what we're doing right now on that, a lot of times that probably won't be a shareable medical expense to Solidarity Healthshare, because we're developing a network right now of crisis pregnancy centers, and we're reaching them, and they have such beautiful donors there. So a lot of those expenses are usually picked up by the crisis pregnancy center, because not only do we have to make sure that baby's not aborted, we also have to make sure that mom's protected spiritually and mentally as well. So that's what we're those member guidelines are going to be coming out here in the next month. And it's the same thing. What we're doing is many of these Christian ministries, they don't share in medical expenses for self-inflicted wounds by teenagers and such like that. And what we do there is that's a shareable medical expense under these new member guidelines, because when people do that, they're not right, and they need help. And I want to be here to minister to them, not only with their corporal needs, but also their spiritual needs as well. And so those are some of the changes we're doing. And I'll give you another example of one. I'll tell the bishop's name too, because he's a good guy. Bishop Vasha sat me down, and he's one of our spiritual advisors, great man out of Santa Rosa. He's only one of two bishops in this country that has revoked the Catholic status of a hospital in his diocese when he was up in Oregon. And he said, Brad, one of your members goes to a Catholic hospital, and then they have after their C-section, they tie the tubes. And because they assume that since they're in the Catholic hospital and they were pushed to do that, they thought it was morally permissible. And your member guidelines, it clearly says that that's not a shareable medical expense. Would you share in that medical expense of the intentional sterilization of a woman? So my wisdom, I just asked him a follow-up question. What do you think we should do, Your Excellency? So, and that's how you get out of any of those hard questions with the bishop, by the way. So, yeah, and he basically said, I don't know, Brad. I'm just, you know, raising the question here. So these are tough questions, because what's the most important thing is that woman's soul, right? And so if we can lovingly call her, sit her down, tell her what she did was morally unacceptable, but this time we would share in that medical expense, I think that would be the right thing to do. And the other issue, too, is with Solidarity Healthshare, with the new member guidelines, we're also going to be paying for a one-time sterilization reversal attempt. You know, and so it happens a lot. I know a couple of my good friends, when they were Protestant, they got vasectomies. And now when they came into the church and realized that against God's plan for creation, you know, the potential mutilization of a man's body like that, they went and paid the $3,000, you know, to get the sterilization attempt to reverse. That's something we want to share in those medical expenses with the person. Because if they're trying to get back to wholeness again and how God intended to be, we want to help facilitate that. So we want to encourage that. So that's what we're about at Solidarity Healthshare. And it's about ethical maximalism. And one of my mentors is Father Robert Spitzer, and we have a lot of conversations about that. It's pretty easy to be an ethical, well, not, I shouldn't say it's easy, but ethical minimalism is a low bar that a lot of people don't hit. But we got to go far above that bar to try to reach out to that soul, to bring as many people in through love of Christ as we can. And medical expenses hit everybody. Would you agree? What a great opportunity to evangelize. Would you agree? Yeah, and that's what one of my prayers is too. Is, and is I pray they privatize Medicare. I would love to get in the Medicare market. Why? Because what we're doing our elderly right now with euthanasia. And as an estate planning attorney, I got my legal documents in order to protect my clients, but I'm constantly being called at least once a month, sometimes a couple times a month, where I'm fighting for my clients' lives in a hospital. And again, who controls the payer system controls the ethics. Agreed? If we can control the ethics in Medicare through some type of solidarity Medicare program, we can bring the culture of death back, because we're getting close to losing that argument on euthanasia. Christian suffering is a lost art in this country. And so that's one of the things we really have to teach. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Brad Hahn, for all that you do. And as now you understand.